and surpassed, penetrating and perfect dharma is rarely met with, even 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just realized that this is the last talk I'm going to give before I go to Spain, because next week we have a one-day sitting and it's entirely silent. Oops.
I think we're okay with you taking the mask off, I was going to say.
Yeah, next week we have a one-day sitting, but it's entirely silent, so I'm not going to lecture. So I don't know, it just hit me. I've been debating about lecturing between two. I'm talking relatively informally because there's nobody new here. But I was debating between two different things to talk about, and now I just added a third. We'll see. I want to say a few things about going to Spain. I'm reminded of Dogen saying, what's the use of going off here and there to dusty realms? And Spain is, parts of Spain are dusty realms. There's a part of Spain that looks like Switzerland. It's really green and hilly in the area around Galicia and part of the Basque country. I didn't realize quite how green it was until I spent some time there, because the rest of Spain is, well, right along the eastern coast is also green, but not the same way. It's green like Big Sur is green, and this is like Ireland or something. At any rate, that's not where I'm going. I'm going to the dusty realms. And it's not a practice event. I don't have any appointments to give Dharma talks anywhere or to see anybody's temple or anything. I have some connection with somebody who lived and practiced. I mean, I have a friend who lived and practiced in Valencia for years. And I know Zen people in Madrid, but I'm not contacting them. And my life is practice. So, how do I not? I certainly mean to pay attention. And I am very interested in the architecture of the Moorish times, though that architecture continued on, because the the Spaniards, they're all Spaniards in my view, but all those people who lived there for a long centuries, but the Catholic Spaniards expelled all of the Moorish and Jewish Spaniards in 1492. That date may be familiar to you. This Ferdinand and Isabella, whom we set up on pedestals, they were called Los Reyes Católicos, the Catholic king and queen. And that's because they expelled all these people. They either they had a, choice, she said, with air quotes. They could either leave or be killed or convert. And so a lot of people converted, maybe for real, and maybe probably, and a lot of times not for real, but they were, for example, forced to eat pork to show that they had renounced their Muslim and or Jewish practices and faith. And they'd hang a leg of ham, a leg of ham, you know, their jamon. It looks like, I guess it's a form of what may be more familiar to you as prosciutto. And so that leg of dried meat would be, you know, they'd like hang it from the window to show that they were good Catholics. And some of the Moors who stayed were continued to be used to build and decorate buildings. So the things that you see with lots of tile, those tend to be Moorish. There's a name for some, you know, the earlier stuff is like the Alhambra in Granada is plain old Moorish. It was a Moorish, I guess a castle is the best word for it. I'm not sure. Is that the best word for it, Lisa? For the Alhambra is a castle. It was somewhat of a fort. You're muted, my dear.
I would say it's like a palace.
Yes, it is a palace, but I think it's also, yeah, that's a better word than a castle, but it was also somewhat of a fort, but at any rate, it was a palace built by a Moorish king. If you ever read The Moor's Last Sigh by, I'm blocking his name, he's the one that Khomeini issued a fatwa against. Salman Rushdie. Anyway, it's about that time. I mean, one of the things it's about is that time. But at any rate, the architecture continued, but it interests me. So the sort of general name for it is Mudéjar. And it is found more in the south than the north. So that's why I'm going to, I'm going through really dusty realms through what's called Extremadura. That's the famous plains of Spain. If you ever say, heard My Fair Lady, the rain in Spain does not fall mainly on the plain. But at any rate, that's the land of Don Quixote. And there are windmills. But what I love that I love the look of it. And I've been to these places, most of them that I'm going to, all except Cordoba. And I've seen these things. I've been to the Alhambra twice. But I wasn't that interested. I mean, I love looking at it, but I wasn't really that interested in the architecture. And now I am much more, and I've actually read things about it and about that history. And what strikes me about the earlier times before Ferdinand and Isabella were also engaged in the initiation of the Inquisition. They were fine people. Anyhow. Well, let's not start on Columbus. I won't start on Columbus. At any rate, but before that time, there were lots of examples of people getting along and thriving. That was especially true of the Moors and the Jews. may it happen again. And there were often Jews in high position in Moorish courts. And places like Toledo and Seville. It feels a little pretentious to me, for me, to say Sevilla. Though I notice I'm pronouncing the names with Spanish accent. Well, with a Mexican accent, which is what I am. At any rate, there were, you know, there was a lot of contact and a lot of appreciation of each other's culture and learning. And it was a very rich culture, and they played chess with each other and so on. And even married each other. So that interests me doubly, to think that there was this tolerance. I mean, I imagine there were difficulties and so on. I don't want to be naive about it. But yet, there was a very rich culture, and then things changed. And Spain was and is the poorer for it. I mean, nowadays, Jews live in Spain, but it is very interesting and saddening that you go to somewhere like Toledo and they show you these empty synagogues, beautifully decorated, beautiful places, but sort of dead. You know, there are a few people that practice in some of them, but it's you're being shown ancient history more than a living religious practice. I don't know if that's changed recently, but I've read stories about how, you know, there's one person or two families that still keep it up. Because also during, you know, Franco was a big friend of Hitler's and Mussolini's and so on, so I don't imagine that he was very friendly to Jews either. They were officially neutral during World War II, but I don't know. Lisa, is what I'm saying about the Jews nowadays accurate, as far as you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to find any trace of Jewish culture, even in places like Barcelona, in Catalonia and Girona, where there were a lot of a big Jewish population in the 15th century. It's not a living thing, like you say. You can't get a matzo ball soup anywhere.
Well, that's a different
or a latke. Yeah,
those are both Ashkenazi.
Yeah.
But you can get, there's a lot of the food that is left, like fried artichokes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, it's not so much a living thing. I am very interested in when it was and seeing how amazingly beautiful it is. There's a mosque, a famous mosque in Cordoba. It's called the Mezquita. And I've never seen it, and I want to see it. Cordoba is in the south of Spain, it's sort of a little north in between Seville and Granada. And I think that ancient time is something that really draws me to Spain. I've been there three times before, and I speak Spanish not great anymore. My accent's still pretty good, but my vocabulary is fading, and I don't know I'm always sort of guessing about the conjugation of verbs, because when I was taught Spanish, I was taught that you never use the familiar except with your family. Well, that's, if it was true then, it's not true anymore. And so for me, especially the you plural familiar, I'm always sort of guessing. And I may be guessing right, but I don't know. Another thing that attracts me to Spain, and I don't know how much it feels what I'm about to say anymore. It certainly did. The last time I was there was in 98, in the fall of 1998. So it's been a long time. And Spain has been through terrible economic times and come out of it, and now they're dealing with COVID. But what I would say, my experience is that there's something wild about it. There's something wild about Spain. Passionate. And in a different way from, say, Italy. It's not as sunny. And I don't mean the sun up in the sky. I just mean there's something dark about it. It's got a dark side to it. And I feel at home there. I don't feel at home because I'm so conscious of not being Spanish and also of my difficulties with the language. And I know sometimes I sound, the last time, a couple of times I was there, I didn't even try to use the familiar. And now I'm much more conscious of the fact that just everybody does. And talking to a stranger on the street. So I am trying now, but I feel like it's stilted and I don't know the idioms. So I can say something, but it sounds often, I think, very formal or just archaic or anyway. So I don't feel like I'm at home in that way, but there's something about it that feels like a home to me. It speaks to my heart. And I don't know where that this is in terms of practice or whatever, you guys are all substantially younger than I am, so this sounds harder to hear to you than it does to me to say, this is probably the last big international trip that I'll take. The day I leave, I'll turn 78. And also, I don't have that kind of money. My trip is being paid for by the city of Oakland. When I shattered my elbow, I wound up suing them because of the way they didn't maintain the weeds, and this long grass fell over the sidewalk and you couldn't see the curb. And it had problems this case, so I didn't make big bucks, but enough to go to Spain. So I thank the city of Oakland, and now it feels like it was worth it. But there's something just about facing, seriously facing death, but it isn't, you know, it doesn't feel like that. It's just, this is just my reality. You know, I don't have a lot more time. And I don't know how much longer I'll be able to drive a car or, you know, get about on my own. You know, I can't lift a huge suitcase up, and I could lift it up onto the curb or something, but I couldn't, you know, I can no longer, I can't put my, if I take a, just a carry-on, but a, you know, like a bigger size carry-on, I can't put it up on the, there's always somebody to do it. There's one of the perks of being an old lady is that people help you. But it is, I'm reminded that Uchiyama Roshi said somewhere that people kind of scolded him for talking about death and dying all the time. And his response was, I'm old. I'm facing it. We old people, we talk about it. Because that's what's going on with us. And it is, and it's bittersweet. But it's also something about seizing the moment, being willing to step into something that I love, that something that really calls to me, and knowing my fears about it, which I do have, but not being pulled around by those feelings, not being pulled around by that emotion of anxiety, like, can I really do this? What if there's a lot of stairs somewhere, and I have this bag? Yes, it's a spinner. But, you know, it's good, big check-in kind of bag. But those what-ifs, that's the kind of thing that we work with in Zazen, right? We work with setting that aside, setting it aside. What if this happens? What if that happens? What if I'm not good enough? What if I can't do it? And we can thwart ourselves and prevent ourselves from living the adventure that's our life by getting wrapped up in the what ifs. And we can make it much harder on ourselves, I think, if we get too bound up in the what ifs. I talk with the lawyers about this because it's so easy when you practice law to get the word that came to me is trapped, but I'm not hindered, say, hindered by the what ifs. You do need to anticipate, you need to know, you know, the what if we lose, or what are the weaknesses in my case, and so on. But it's important to not get paralyzed by it, or even hindered to the extent you can avoid that. And it isn't just lawyers who do that, we all do it. Don't do it. Stop it. So, I talked a lot about that, and I'll take questions about both things, but I came across this last night. I was looking for, actually it was yesterday afternoon, I don't want you to think I didn't repeat. I was looking for something else, and I came across Mahasagra Fu, 497 to 569. He's the protagonist, I guess, in case 67 of the Blue Cliff record. And Cicada thinks this is, that he's probably fictional, which he may be. And the case sounds, the case itself sounds familiar. And he was at the time of Emperor Wu of Liang. And we haven't used that particular case that much, but that's the case we sometimes called Bodhidharma coming from the West, or I'm in the right place. I just had the wrong book in mind. Okay. Yeah, the case in this one is called The Highest Meaning of the Holy Truths, and it's about Bodhidharma coming from the West, and he met Emperor Wu of Liang and asked him, Wu, who built lots of monasteries and stupas and you name it, and acquired a lot of merit, asked him, what's the highest meaning of the holy truths? And Bodhidharma says, vast emptiness, nothing holy. So Mahasattva Fu also knew Emperor Wu of Liang. And I hope he was before Bodhidharma, because he comes across as clueless here too. So I want to do, there's a poem that he wrote to, or advice that he gave to Emperor Wu, that I want to focus on. It really struck me. But the description of him in the little biographies here, and at the end of this edition of the Blue Cliff Record, there are biographies of everybody, and they're organized by case number. But at any rate, he was a lay person. He was Mahasattva, he was a great being, Fu. And also called Shanhui. And he was a farmer, and then he eventually practiced. He eventually gave up all of his possessions and gave alms to the poor. And he sold his wife and children, according to this. This is the kind of thing you find in these biographies. And it's like, that's something admirable. You know, like Dongshan left his mother. Or no, Dongshan, yeah, I did. And Huai Neng left his mother. That one says that he made arrangements for her. But I don't know. Anyway, you know, this is a time of, you know, kind of Confucianism, and you take care of your family. And they were not enslaved out of respect for him, by the way, just so you know. But he worked, and he gave away all of the money that he made, and he fed the poor, and he's thought of as a really great, and he taught the Dharma. And he went into Liang a lot of times to preach, and that's how he came to the emperor's attention. And the following is a summary of three levels of goodness to which Fu enjoined Emperor Wu of Liang in his first letter to the monarch. The high, and here this is what they are. The highest good has an empty heart as its basis. We've been talking about what's love, an empty heart. The highest good has an empty heart as its basis, and a non-attachment as its source. Non-attachment as its source, it arises out of emptiness. Abolishment of formality is the cause, and nirvana is the result. It's on page 623 of the Cleary edition, in case anybody wants to know.
What book is that?
Something called The Blue Cliff Record. It's a collection of koans. Teaching stories. And it looked like Liam was writing something down, so I thought he probably has the book, so I thought I'd tell him. Anyway, the highest good has an empty heart as its basis and non-attachment as its source. Abolishment of formality is the cause. Abolishment of formality. I'm not sure. You know, that's a translation, and the Clearys are really good. But I bet you that it's, you know, I don't know what the word meant to whom and so on. There is a translation the refuges or something that Reb uses. It says something about following forms and rituals. And it maybe it is a literal translation, but I think it's that kind of thing can be lacking. And formality is the abolishment of formality is the cause. And I think that what I think it means is something about a radical elimination of separation, a radical intimacy. No more me, mine, something like that. Not setting up false barriers. He's not here. He may not have existed. But abolishment of formality is the cause, and nirvana is the result. The middling good, I'll just tell you the rest of it, but it was that, I was really struck by that empty heart. Oh yeah, when we studied the Heart Sutra, we talked about that a lot. The middling good has government of oneself as its basis and government of the nation as its source. The fruits experienced by gods and humans will be peace and happiness. So govern yourself. The least good is to protect and nourish living beings, to overcome cruelty and abolish murder, and to have all the farmers receive free food 6 times a month. Well, I don't know. Maybe they all got, you know, portions of rice.
She seems so specific.
Yeah. Well, it probably had, who knows? There's, you know, a basis in their practice. But just such a great, the highest good as an empty heart as its basis and non-attachment as its source. Bingo. So do you have any questions or comments or anything? I just lost the place. But yeah.
I'm really encouraged by your trip that you're going, and I feel excited a little bit. It feels brave to me, and I don't know. I'm happy that you're going, and we're going to miss you. That's what I'm saying. And I think it's pretty cool to go by yourself and have all this unknown, and to trust yourself and trust that everything will align for you well. And I want you to have a great time. That's what I want to say.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, it is brave, but it's also true that I think people are brave who go traveling with another person and deal with all that. So there's a way in which it's sort of, I don't know, selfish isn't the word, but anyway, it's easier for me to do that, to do what I'm doing. And I will be meeting people. I mean, I've meeting some friends of Lisa's and some friends of friends, da da da, and da da dee dee, and there are people. Anybody else you can ask about?
Yeah. I wonder if you see a link between knowledge of the history of Spain and the Moorish people and the Jewish people and your practice. You know, like, is it something you feel like you want to share that story more, or, I mean, is there some link between, knowing about it and practicing it?
Well, it inspires me, mm-hmm. you know, the inclusivity of it. It inspires me, and particularly in these times, and unfortunately, they descended into a kind of darkness. So, it's maybe a cautionary tale too about, you know, really overdoing the sense of separation. You get into the Crusades and all that stuff. So yeah, but not, you know, not, it's in the background. Anything else? Any comments on empty hearts or the meaning of love, whatever that is? Or, I'm sorry? Yes?
My son just turned 30 yesterday. And I was just filled with this kind of feeling of maybe a touch of emptiness in terms of remembering carrying him in my body, giving birth to him, and feeling the bones and the flesh, literally, I'm sorry, this is too much, but connecting with an animal, literally giving birth, and remembering a cat when I was a little girl having her kittens, and I could feel him coming into the world, literally, bone by bone. And right before that, such a pain that I wish for death. And something holding you on that's ancient, that's beyond you.
Mm-hmm.
And here he is, warm in my arms, and then the years of raising him, devoting myself to him and our family. And yet he was this whole universe of his own self. And then he leaves, and I have to let go of that, and I have let go, and he's become himself, but there's something left behind, you know, but there's nothing left behind. So it's like both are true,
mm-hmm.
and the love is the only thing that continues on for me, you know, and I think that's how I can experience emptiness, is through that experience of being a mother. And then trying not to get caught up in the identity of it too much, like, you know, clinging, the not letting go. So it helps me, that experience helps me to understand emptiness.
You remind me of a friend of mine, Karen Dakotas. And at her Fuseau ceremony a long time ago, she was talking, she had relatively recently been married, and so I don't remember what the question was or what prompted it, but what she said was that in being Fuseau, she had learned that she could love everybody or want to, her goal, or so, I'm trying to avoid words like goal, but aspiration or whatever, but that she felt, she said, oh, I realized I should love everybody the way I love my husband. Can I open, I'm now commenting, but, you know, can I open my heart to everybody the way I open my heart to my family? That's the kind of love that I'm talking about, or trying to talk about. This is going to go on for a while. And I hope that you, as you sit with it, you keep, you know, it's the kind of thing that keeps turning and keeps opening up. You know, what agape, what does that mean? I mean, now there's definitions of it, but what is that? Okay, anybody else? Last call? Yeah, Asha?
Yeah, I have a question on attachment.
Yeah. What about it?
Yeah. So it may be a little bit off subject, but maybe not. But like if when you're sitting and meditating and, okay, I'll just speak for myself. Today's meditation, I really wanted to hold on to my inhale and my breath. I wanted to just hold on to it because it felt really good. And then I feel like I've got to correct myself and not try to hold on to anything and just be present. So, and I know obviously this correlates to life and into life, but I'm wondering in the setting of a meditation, how do you deal with attachments?
You notice it and you exhale. And you, I mean, just try holding on to it.
You
can't. I mean, there's a wonderful book called Breath by Breath, and this is very different because what you were in being interested, that interested in your inhale is useful. But this young man came in to talk to Musong and Doksan, I guess, and he said he was just really bored by his breath, and. Musong said, yeah, okay, pinch your nose, close your mouth, and you just sit there. And, the guy did for a while, and pretty soon, you know, he had to gasp for a breath. And Musong said, was that interesting? Which, of course, it was, because he would have died if he... I mean, I don't know if you can, because you've got to lose consciousness and then you're going to breathe. But at any rate, you'll have to let go of your attachment for that moment. And otherwise, just watch it and notice that you're very focused on the inhale. And see if you can, you know, just keep noticing. Notice what it feels like. You know, there's an inhale, there's a pause, and then there's an exhale, and then there's another pause. And sometimes we can get caught up, and we instead of allowing the next breath to come in naturally, we pull it in. And I don't know. I mean, that may be part of the attachment, and that may have something to do with the pause. As much as with the in-breath. Because that pause is called the little death. And it can be anxiety producing, leading to not nirvana, but leading to hurrying the breath. So just watch and just see, notice the detail of it. See if, I mean, that isn't necessarily the case for you. I know, because I did it for a while. And I don't know if at some point I notice, oh, I'm pulling that breath in. I'm not just letting it do its thing. Because it will come. It will come naturally. You don't need to pull it in. But anyway, don't worry about it.
Thank you.
Just get to know it. Take a kindly, friendly, compassionate, loving interest in it. Okay? Anything else? You guys online, you're welcome to ask questions or comment if you want. You don't have to. Lisa?
I just wanted to say thank you for your talk on Spain. I enjoyed hearing about how you know, how it sort of resides in your heart. Like I relate to that sense of it. There's something about Spain, about, and what you're talking about, this sort of wildness and darkness of that place. And I don't know if it's still the same. I don't know. It's changed a lot. But when the last time I was there, I went twice this year because of the residency. I had to go and put the application in and I had to go and pick it up. And the first time I felt, oh, it's so different. It's changed so much. It's just unrecognizable. And because everything has become so highly digitalized now, you know, that used to be like, you had to get some kind of certificate or, you know, for turning in papers. It was like the old kind of guy in the bank with a stamp, you know, they don't do that anymore. And the second time I went, I thought the opposite. I thought, oh my God, there's still these old man bars with the loud, you know, clang, clang, clang of the slot machines, and people are still smoking on the streets, and you're walking down the street and you're inhaling, you know, like it's still, there's still so much of it that is the same. And they're still serving the same food that they always ate, you know, it's so it has that kind of mixture of being modernized beyond recognition, but yet there's this part of Spain that's still there.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to not get my, you know, not be disappointed or not be too, you know, that, I mean, I'm already looking at restaurants and trying to kind of figure out where to eat kind of, you know, sometimes. And I've been, one of the things I've been struck by is how breakfast menus have changed. A lot of places now serve American kind of breakfast. And so there's Eggs Benedict.
Yeah.
Pancakes, and I don't know what all, you know, it that's not been the Spanish way. You know, breakfast was sort of a, you know, a roll or croissant or toasted baguette and some coffee or café con leche or something. But, you know, it wasn't what we think of as breakfast. And now it's quite a lot of places. And that, those were the ones I eliminated. But I may need, you know, who knows? Who knows? But that's a relatively small thing, but it's an example. It feels like creeping United States-ism.
Well, yeah, there's definitely like the hipster kind of culture is there for sure, you know, and the kind of like fancy schmancy kind of hipsterified restaurants are definitely there, but the old stuff is also, they exist side by side.
Right. Well, we'll see. Okay.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are bound.